The Creative Nonfiction Podcast is sponsored by Goucher College's Master of Fine Arts in Nonfiction. The Goucher MFA is a two-year, low-residency program. Online classes let you learn from anywhere, while on-campus residencies allow you to hone your craft with accomplished mentors who have Pulitzer Prizes and best-selling books to their names. The program boasts a nationwide network of students, faculty, and alumni, which has published 140 books and counting. You'll get opportunities to meet literary agents and learn the ins and outs of the publishing journey. Visit goucher.edu/nonfiction to start your journey now. Take your writing to the next level and go from hopeful to published in Goucher's MFA program for nonfiction. Are you riffing kidding me? You know what I'm talking about. By virtue of today's guest, I'm assuming there might be a new CNF or two to our little marauding gang of turbulent souls in this corner of the internet. Welcome. We play heavy metal music, we kick maximum ass, and we will rock you. This is the Creative Nonfiction Podcast, the show where I speak to badass tellers of true stories and where they came from, what and who inspires them, and how they approach the work, so that you can apply those tools of mastery to your own work. I'm your mother riffing host, Brendan O'Mara. Hey. Today's guest is none other than Pulitzer Prize winning author Tracy Kidder, author of, take a breath, Brendan, Soul of a New Machine, Among School Children, Old Friends, Hometown, My Detachment, Good Prose, Mountains Beyond Mountains, Strength and What Remains, A Truck Full of Money, and House. That, CNFers, is a body of work. Speaking of a body of work, today's podcast is also brought to you by Creative Nonfiction Magazine. For nearly 25 years, Creative Nonfiction has been fuel for nonfiction writers and storytellers, publishing a lively blend of exceptional long and short form nonfiction narratives and interviews, as well as columns that examine the craft, style, trends, and ethics of writing true stories. In short, creative nonfiction is true stories well told. And who tells them better than Tracy Kidder, friends? He's been a literary hero of mine ever since I got into this freaking mess. If you're as big a head case as I am, I'd go ahead and read Good Prose, the book he wrote with his longtime editor and former mentor of mine, Dick Todd. It lets you know that you're not alone in this in these increasingly digital times, and it's easier to, you know, feel, what's the word, shitty. Tracy's an apex CNFer in a long line that have appeared on this show. Please enjoy this conversation with the one, the only, Tracy Kidder.
Let's do it.
Yeah. So when you were a younger writer coming up, what did a successful writer look like to you in your 20s and 30s?
Well, really on, anyone who had been published, yeah. You know, it was... At first, at least, that was, it seemed like enough, you know, just to be, to get something published in a particularly, but then of course, the issue of making a living arose. And whom did I admire or,
what did it look like to you? And then of course, you know, maybe who were some of those writers that were your gold standard too at the time?
Right. I mean, I thought when I first started out, I fancied myself a novelist, and but that didn't seem to be working out. And I mean, at some point, I went from, you know, thinking from sort of grand ambitions of writing something, as my best teacher said, of something classic, to writing something publishable. And I guess it stayed that way for a while. I mean, there was a big difference between imagining myself among the right. You know, really, I think that's the best answer. That's the truest answer. But I just saw it as a, I just want to get published. You know, mm-hmm. That's the best that I can remember. And then of course other things arise. But and I had my heroes, my enthusiasm. You know, they range from pretty early on from John McPhee. I liked Tom Wolfe quite a lot. At certain times, this enthusiasm was waxing and waning. Although I mean, I still like lots of things about both of those writers. I also had some. George Orwell was a big mm-hmm. deal to me, seemed like a big deal to me. I remember being really taken by his books. I don't think I liked Down and Out in Paris and London when I first started to read it in high school, but I really came to like it later, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know what else to say. You know, the idea of becoming, of making a living as a writer seemed daunting enough to me right. at a certain point, you know, and I kind of glummed. I was, I had a friend named, whom I'd met, and he taught briefly at Iowa, named Dan Wakefield, who was a pretty distinguished journalist. He started writing novels. A pretty well-known journalist. I think he was a distinguished journalist. He helped me get my foot in the door of the Atlantic Monthly. And he also had the great good sense to say that, I should try to work with this guy, Dick Todd. So, and that was probably the best advice I ever got. So pretty quickly, you know, I stopped having quite such highfalutin fantasies. I just trying to figure out how to be a useful enough writer for a magazine without, you know, that they would keep publishing me and I might be able to make a little money. But it was pretty, I'm mindful. There's a great line in an Updike essay about Ted Williams, which is just a sort of, not a throwaway line, but it's a, you know, not a big deal, but it stuck with me, which he was talking about Ted Williams being accused of not being a clutch hitter, and he was poo-pooing that, but then he also said, but if to the extent that it's true, a clutch hitter, I'm paraphrasing, but clutch hitter's a vulgarity, like a writer who writes only for money. So that's a nice line, because of course you have to write for money if you're trying to make a living, but if you wrote only for money, you know, that would be a different sort of thing. Anyway,
yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I love that line. Yeah.
You know, so real. So that's pretty much the way it was. I didn't have enormous expectations for myself after I got, you know, after I was really involved in trying to, you know, it's hard enough, you know, to go out and do research and so on and just hope to make a little money.
Yeah.
I hope I never really felt sorry for myself, and, you know, earnestly did, because no one asks you to be a writer. But it was, it had its difficulties, you know.
What would you say when you made that pivot, that conscious pivot to writing magazine articles at the time, and going to that nonfiction pivot versus trying to be the novelist, and when you're coming out of the Iowa Writers' Workshop, to what were you struggling with at the time during that pivot?
Well, I ran out of somehow or other the well that I had drawn on for some years for writing fiction. We just seemed to be drying up. I'd written a really terrible novel, which I've made abundant fun of in a book of mine called My Detachment. It was also the fact that at Iowa, there were wonderful, there were some wonderfully accomplished writers that, you know, already in, among the students, among like my friend, my really great friend, Stuart Dybeck, but others as well. In fact, there was, it was really quite a lot of fast company. And I just felt, my God, you know, I wanted to try my hand at something else that no one else was doing right around there. Because it suddenly occurred to me, and there was a guy proselytizing for this too, but, you know, if you, I think I had by then read the electric Kool-Aid acid test, for instance, and pretty sure I had, you know, just the possibilities of doing something similar in nonfiction really did appeal to me. I can't remember exactly all my motives and so on. Part of it, I think, was, you know, not to feel this very intimidating competition from my peers there, but I think it was also that I must have sensed that this would be good for me to get out into the world a little further and so on. Mm. I don't know. I was still pretty confused. I was just back from Vietnam, just married, but kind of strictly from hunger. So, you know, it's hard to remember all of it.
To your point too about maybe, you know, the nonfiction writing being something that few of your peer group was doing, and also getting you, I think relieving some stress from the pressures of fiction is this great quote that you cited from McPhee in Good Prose, which says that things that are cheap and tawdry in fiction work beautifully in nonfiction because they're true. And he goes on a little bit, but that is, to that point, it kind of frees you from having to use imagination to come up with something that is not cliche, but if it is in fact reportedly true, then you can lean into it, and there's beauty in that. So I think there's that.
Yeah, I mean,
going
it doesn't,
on.
Yeah, I think that's a complicated thought. I appreciate that thought from him. Of course, nowadays we're in the midst of idiotic arguments about fact, you know.
Right.
But you know, there are some things that are true. They're factual, and it's not. And I think he's absolutely right. On the other hand, it's imagination is you still need it, and the reason you need it is that it's not always enough simply to say this is true. I mean, this is demonstrably true. You have to make the reader believe that, and you know, and also there's God, there's so many things involved, and I think he said that too, that there's lots of artistry involved. There's the issues of tone that become enormous even when you're dealing with something you know happened. How do you present this, and you know, how do you make this part of the fabric of what you're writing, and how do you make it convincing? You know, I think what I said this somewhere long ago, that part of your job is to make what's true, what's you know, you have justifiable belief in, believable to your readers, because you know sometimes things just be hard believable that actually have happened. You've got to find a way to do it. There's a ton more involved too, I guess. But anyway,
it was something that always struck me about your work too. Is something I call like backyard narratives, and you. Early in your career, especially, so much of what you did in a lot of your books, whether it was House or Among School Children and Old Friends, a lot of the stuff was in your backyard. And what did that teach you about the power of story and the power of narrative, that you never had to go very far to find a great story?
Well, I mean, I think that I felt it was convenient too. You know, I had a young family, and
yeah,
but and I. It's weird though. It strikes me as really strange because, well, I'll get to that. That's an old kind of an old adage, right? I mean, there's people would talk about Faulkner and Yaknepatawpha County, or what's the range, the geographic range of Flannery O'Connor's writing. You know, it seemed obvious to me that if I could find interesting people nearby, and I knew I could, why not? Why not stay here? I like the region, and I began to feel I understood it, you know. But then, and that worked pretty well for me. Although the Soul of a New Machine was, I mean, I was in Massachusetts in New England, but it was a certain distance away and, you know, a lot closer to the city. But anyway, at some point, though, later, I mean, I guess it was around 2000 or no, but before that, the 90s, I started to, just when I was getting too old to travel comfortably, you know, it's like it's more addicted to my comforts and stuff. I started doing it. I think it was first to Haiti and then somewhat later, 6 years later, Paul Farmer. And then I was off into, you know, all over the place with him. And then I was in Africa with Deo. And, this is continued on to some degree.
Yeah.
Lots of traveling. Yeah. Anyway, certainly, you know, then Boston, which feels very different from my backyard, you know, Boston with a lot of travel with the people who were headquartered there. So it's, I find this kind of odd I'm sort of sad about it because I don't enjoy travel very much anymore. I was just in the Netherlands and for research and I just came back exhausted. I was exhausted the whole time I was there. So I don't know. Anyway, I should have done it the other way around. Probably.
Right. I always thought of that. It did seem kind of in reverse. You find a lot of like young writers are very, you know, ambitious in terms of their travel. Will go to every corner of the earth to get it, and then maybe later in life they can tone it down and be a bit more rural.
But you know, as I think about it, probably the best thing I did for the Atlantic Monthly really was a traveling piece. I did two pieces out of it. I wanted to find out about Vietnam combat veterans. This is in 78, I guess I did it. Now I traveled all over the country by train. So I also wanted to write a little bit. So a little thing about trains, but I wrote a big long cover story about the Vietnam combat veterans, which they called, it wasn't my title, but Todd named it, I guess, called it Soldiers of Misfortune. It was, and it was pretty, that was a good article. It got nicely received. So I did that, and that was a lot of travel. God, some of it wonderful, frankly.
Yeah, seeing the country by train must have been pretty cool.
It's pretty cool. Yeah, there were probably some flights in there, but I was in spent a fair amount of time in Alabama, which was really interesting to me. But anyway. Let's go on. I'm sorry.
Oh, no. I love hearing all about it. Speaking of a younger point in your career when you're trying to get that toehold in magazine publishing and, of course, what it would eventually be book publishing, in good prose, too, there were moments there, the fleck through, like, where, you know, I think your father left, like, a law school application, you know, in your direction.
Several.
And I think a lot of writers, especially as you're getting into your 30s and get kind of mid-career and certain things just aren't quite happening, and they have that fork in the road, that law school fork in the road. What gave you the strength or the confidence to keep pursuing your narrative craft and not take that other road?
Well, I started to have a little success. I'd written a pretty bad book about a murder case. It got published and then sort of vanished without a trace. It was pretty bad though. So in retrospect, I'm glad it did, but then I started doing stuff for The Atlantic, and I was getting published routinely. I wasn't making enough money really to live on. If my wife hadn't had some income, we would have been on food stamps, I think. But, you know, we were never in terrible jeopardy, and I always had that sense I could do something else. I had pretty good education. And I don't know. It seemed like momentum, you know. I remember at a certain point, though, this I remember, Todd reminded me of this not a long time ago, actually. he had come over. He was over at dinner, and I had been offered a job. I had applied to a lot of newspapers to get a job, you know, just to get a regular sort of steady income. And I hadn't gotten any response at all, even though I'd written a fair amount of stuff for The Atlantic. Some of it, you know, it's creditable anyway. And I got a job offer from the Detroit Free Press. Interesting paper, you know, an interesting town. And I remember sitting at dinner with Todd and arguing that I should take this. And Todd was saying, you're doing fine. Just, you know, I think at the time I'd had a complete failure of a project for an As Told To book I was trying to do to make some money. But Todd said, you're doing fine. Just don't do this. Just keep doing what you're doing. And I said at some point, I said, well, look, if I go there and I really work hard and I get lucky, I could win the Pulitzer. And he said, just keep doing what you're doing. And then when I remember the night I heard that was getting a Pulitzer, I told him, and he reminded me of this, which is, I thought, okay, you were right again, as usual.
Yeah.
It almost always has been in my experience. So it wasn't so tempting to me. Once I started getting published, it just seemed, you know, I could feel desperate from time to time, but the only real fork that beckoned to me was to actually get a job in the newspaper. I'm pretty glad I didn't do that, but it wouldn't have been harmful. But I knew that that was an avenue that some writers had taken, and so I thought, well, this might work, you know. But it was, you know, it was the era when newspaper jobs were kind of dwindling already, and particularly for white guys.
Yeah.
Oh, maybe it wasn't. I don't know. I can't be sure. But newspapers weren't. I mean, there were still jobs. Don't get me wrong, but there weren't that many.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe they were starting to lose their luster a bit. But there was still plenty of magazine. There were inches in magazines to write for.
And plenty of newspapers too. And that, you know, it was later that everything started to get shredded. Anyway.
Yeah, Dick Todd always had a way of just telling you, like, it's fine, keep going, or something. That always seemed to be, like, the best note he could ever give you.
Well, no, I mean, it's the best at a certain time. I mean, that's very useful for me. But you know, once... That was usually for a rough draft, almost always for a rough draft. And then when I was done, then I'd wonder, and we'd start again. And then, you know, it was apparent that there wasn't that much that he really thought was fine. You know, so, but that was, I always found that, but I always managed to believe in.
Yeah. Yeah, talk about having like that great advocacy in your corner, like in those moments of self-doubt and loneliness and distrust in your story sometimes, to have that voice saying, no, it's good, you know, just keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah, I never felt he was bullshitting me, but anyway, right.
What do you think, especially in those early days when things might have felt overwritten and you're still trying to find that voice, a confident voice on the page. Like, what do you think he was seeing in you that maybe at the time you had yet to see in yourself?
Oh, I don't. You probably have to ask him. I think what he thought was, well, this guy will work hard, you know. Mm-hmm. And his wife once told me that he's always been as willing to work as hard as the writer is. No, but not necessarily harder. And I think I was sort of a willing pupil, and I quite deliberately tried to make myself useful. One of the things that occurred to me early on, I think this was one of the few wise things I attempted anyway, was that I could, getting close to people at the magazine, at The Atlantic, I realized that editors have their problems too, you know, and what a writer, an ambitious young writer who wants should be trying to do most of all is to be of use to these editors, to help solve some of their problems, not to add to them, because you're inevitably going to add to them, particularly if you behaved as I did in those days. But I wanted, you know, and so I really tried hard to come up with to do useful work for him. So, you know, and I think to some degree I did do that. So it's often difficult.
How did you behave in those days?
Oh, I drank a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I would, I don't know, he likes to, perhaps it's a little exaggerated, but he certainly did. I drank too much, I'm sure, most of the time, for quite a while. I don't know why, but I did.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I don't know, and I could be sort of explosive. We have very different personalities, you know. He's much more measured. I think I said, wrote in good prose, that he seemed to have been born old.
right.
And anyway, I could not make the same claim.
It's hard for me to picture you as like a big, I know you're a very like tall and imposing physical person, very athletic looking, but it's hard for me to picture you as a booming, aggressive presence, like having heard countless interviews with you, again, met you in person and speaking to you now. And you're very soft spoken, and it's hard for me to have that image of you.
Yeah, well, things are, you know, with different people in different situations, all of us, I think.
Right.
anyway, and it's, I don't do that sort of thing anymore.
Mm-hmm.
There was a time when I was really kind of half out of control.
Yeah.
I was scared a lot of the time too. I mean, how was I going to make a living?
Mm-hmm.
That really was and somehow, coming from a middle class family, where it just seemed so. I felt so humiliated by the idea of not being able to make a living.
Yeah.
With the, you know, whole thing.
Yeah, and having gone to Harvard too, there's that extra pressure if you're not making a living when you've got that diploma on your wall. I'm sure that adds a lot of pressure too.
I don't know. Maybe. Yeah, probably, but not the. It's not. I don't. That wasn't the major thing. I don't think. No.
I think. Todd wrote in that one of your great strengths was that you were not afraid to write badly. And
yeah, I think that's true. I mean, when I first heard it, I was a little, what? Offended. He thinks I write badly. But what he meant was, I know exactly what he meant. And and it's what I've tried to, I have a few people I've helped, including one wonderfully gifted young African writer. But something I try to explain is that don't overthink or overwrite, you know, your rough drafts. Just get it down. And don't worry about it, whether it's any good or not. You've got the great luxury of being able to rewrite. Of course, you know, you don't want to impose your own kind of neurotic ways of doing things on someone else, but it is one way to get things done. And for me, you know, the first drafts of things are always the hardest. And I suspect it's true for a lot of people. And I do know, because I've done it, I used to do it a lot, how one is always tempted to take something one has already written, whether it's any good or not, and work on it rather than plunge ahead into the unknown. It just feels so much safer. So I have tried to cultivate over the years the willingness to write badly. I probably shouldn't have been showing him some of that stuff, and I think I do less often now. But and maybe I write more carefully, but I try not to go back over and over and over something No. And I think that's really important. It has been very important for me.
Yeah, that writing quickly and writing quickly so you can't really even think about what you've written is a great way to at least get down a big chunk of work that you can then start chipping into and using your mm-hmm. taste and your own experience to shape the story. But it's, I think a lot of people mm-hmm. are uncomfortable That's right. with the bad work to get to the good work.
Yeah. But it's also a way of cultivating that, creating the possibility of having just something come to you that you hardly even notice that it really is good. And it's wonderful to have another set of eyes, Todd, that you'd really trust to point out to you that there's something there, it really is good. Mm-hmm. You know, anyway. So.
When you were vetting out stories, what stuck in your brain is like, oh, this is something worth pursuing and taking a deeper dive on? You know, what kind of resonates with you when, you know, you're starting to vet out a story?
Oh, well, I usually just, I don't know. I mean, I don't have an effective procedure for this. Mm-hmm. And I've made mistakes. Usually, you know, I don't know. I have backed out of some things when they didn't seem to blossom for me. That I don't know. I really don't have an answer to that.
Yeah.
You know, because the preliminary curiosity you might feel for a subject, say, can easily, you know, wither if you don't get yourself. If it doesn't, you know, it doesn't. And besides, I don't really look at subjects. I typically look for people, mm-hmm. first of all, you know, and that hasn't always been the case, but generally it's true. You meet someone who interests me, and then I get interested in what interests that person. I don't know, though. It's, you know, it's been so long since I was writing articles that I've sort of forgotten all that, but that was a much more idea-driven endeavor, you know, subject-driven, writing articles about passenger trains or solar energy or things like that I did do.
Yeah.
The Vietnam veteran one, it was something that really interested me. What had happened, and this was that. I mean, it's a little complicated, but it had to do with my own relation to that war. The kind of experience that I had not had there. And then I'd written, that's what that bad novel of mine was about, all about experiences I didn't have over there. And I wondered, you know, really what had happened to the people who had actually been in combat? It's a very small percentage. I think I realized that even then. And when I started out on it, man, it was amazing. It was one of the few stories that were the worst that you know, you often come with these preconceived notions about something, and that's not a bad thing as long as you're willing to let them be shattered and actually to enjoy their shattering. But in this case, it was worse than I had even imagined, you know, and which is sort of delicious sometimes, frankly, one shouldn't be rejoicing in the fact that these guys have been so shafted, but it did make the writing a little easier. There weren't too many, you didn't have to insert too many caveats. Mm-hmm. They had just been horribly treated. So, you know, in every conceivable way, as near as I could tell. But I don't know how I, you know, latched onto it. I sort of do in that case, but other ones, you know, sometimes it came almost as an assignment. Sometimes ideas, I was turned away from ideas, the Atlantic. Saying, well, we're not gonna support you on this one, and things like that, you know. But I don't have I really don't have an answer. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's fine. That's fine. You said that sometimes that you made mistakes or that some didn't blossom and you had to abandon them, how much time do you sometimes give yourself before you abandon a story and invest too much of your time and resources in something?
I don't know. I sometimes give myself a pretty long time. months, sometimes, better part of the year. I mean, I do remember spending, I think I may have written about this, a lot of time after I had written The Soul of a New Machine looking for the next thing to do. Because I saw I had a chance to do this for a living, and I really wanted the perfect subject, which of course doesn't exist ever. I turned away from the one that I ended up with for a good long time. Really was almost, I don't know, a year or two trying other things out. But I did abandon those I did a fair amount of research about wilderness, and then I even remember a long plane ride in a small plane in the winter over the Bob Marshall Wilderness in Montana. Interesting in itself, but I threw that away, and other ideas that I'd had, and came back to the one about a house building, which nobody wanted me to do. Until I told Todd, I said, "Well, I'd really like to try that." And it was as though, he was sort of saying to me, "Why didn't you tell me that before?" So I did. But other times, it was his wife's suggestion that had me write about a school teacher. I can't even remember all the. It was running into Paul Farmer completely by accident that led me to that story eventually, and it was going to visit Paul Farmer at Harvard that was doing that I met Deo Gracias, the guy I wrote about Strength. And I guess actually it was my connection to Partners in Health through Farmer and Deo that it was through that I met this guy, Paul English, whom I wrote about most recently. And what I'm working on now, I happened on to because of that other project.
Yeah.
So, one thing usually leads to another. It's not always that way. But anyway.
When I was talking to Eli Saslow, he takes an approach of, let's say, the border wall. And then he's like, all right, now I need to find, the best set of characters to illustrate what's going on down there. And often he kind of basically like auditions a lot and then just based on taste be like, no, that one is the better of the illustrations that will tell the better story. And kind of what you were saying was kind of the opposite, where you find someone that you're deeply interested in and then you want to find out and learn what interests them. So when did you settle on that as your key indicator of to lean into a particular subject and story?
From the very beginning,
yeah.
I think. Although that wasn't true with the magazine stuff at The Atlantic, but when I came to writing books, it was meeting. Well, I mean, Todd had said, look into computers, but I said, well, how do you want me to look into it? And he knew this guy. So I went to see the guy. The guy interested me. I mean, his connect. It's always been that way. I mean, the one time that I did set out to find a person in a category, a category of person, a school teacher, an elementary school teacher, I thought should be a woman, which should be in a troubled city. Once I found her, I wasn't so much interested anymore. Then my first interest was to her and the children in the classroom, not to the general subject. Even in that case, I felt as though, well, if this is going to say something about the problems of public education in America, it's going to do it, obliquely, because that's just not the kind of book I want to write. I mean, I didn't want to write a book about AIDS and tuberculosis. I wanted to figure out who this freaking guy was, And then, of course, you you've got to become fascinated by the things that preoccupy them, you know?
Of course.
So yeah, you're right. It's an absolutely, it's the opposite approach. I don't know that it makes much difference. The only thing that really matters is what comes out the other end. Right.
Of course. What appeals to you more, the reporting research phase or the writing and rewriting phase?
I used to like them equally, and I maybe like the reporting a little more, and now I emphatically prefer the writing and rewriting, and that's partly just age and also just at this very moment I'm really tired. I love the research I've been doing, and I'd like to keep doing it, but it requires me to drive on the Massachusetts Turnpike too often. And I'm just tired. You know, I get tired more easily. I don't, and you know, logistics start to get in my way.
Yeah.
It's not that I don't, I mean, I've found current research to be really quite wonderfully interesting and even sort of rewarding, but I'd rather be writing it. I mean, what I wish were true is that I like them both in their when I'm doing them best, you know. But I don't think it is quite true anymore. What I really do look forward to just writing. Although you know that always has its downsides too, but mm-hmm. That's what I look forward to now.
And just knowing your relative energy levels and knowing that fatigue might set in, you know, earlier than it used to during whatever process of the of a project you're in. How do you typically set up your days, like morning routines, daily rituals, so you can attack your work with, you know, with rigor tenacity?
Well, research is completely different because you I end up keeping someone else's hours, so I don't set up the day; it gets set up for me in a way, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, there are obviously exceptions to that where you're trying to stack up a bunch of interviews, but that's the least important part of research for me. The most important part is getting to be able to walk alongside the people who are doing something that you're interested in. But when it comes to writing, I do have a sort of routine, which I think started a long time ago, probably when I first had a child. I used to try to write late at night, but that I gave that up and for the early morning. And it's not quite as early now as it used to be. Because now I like to read the paper, but before, mm-hmm. but for years and years and years, I get up really early and I went right to work because that was when my mind was freshest.
Yeah.
And I still like to, morning is time for me to work. Sometimes the afternoon too, but it's not very complicated. Just
mm-hmm. How long can you write in a given sitting without getting tired? It's like, I know I like 30 minute to 45 minute bursts and then taking a little breather. So how do you operate like that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I try to make sure that I get up and walk around a little bit or something. But I mean, I just do that. But I'm not really self-conscious. I'm not really conscious of what I'm doing while I'm there. But I do know there was a time when I guess typically I can't spend too many hours writing rough drafts before I look for other excuses not to be doing it. But when I start to rewrite and things start to move, things start to emerge from the chaos, I can remember days I worked 13 hours pretty much straight. You know, I mean, obviously get up and walk around. In those days I used to smoke. So go and smoke a cigarette, which is my friend, my evil little friend, but I still get up and pace and walk around and, you know, maybe go get the mail or something just for a break. But, so there isn't any, you know, it really has to do with leaving aside all the other things that you end up having to do in your life. it has to do with how well things are going, you know, how difficult it is. So I can spend, you know, better, but I can spend an 8-hour day writing without too much trouble if things are going well, particularly if I'm rewriting. I don't think I'm going to do any more of those 13, 14-hour days, though.
Yeah. I don't know anyone. Well, clearly an older version of yourself was capable of that, but I can't imagine doing that kind of a day. A great thing that Dick Todd's wife had told you is that he was willing to work as hard as the writer. And I always love asking a writer, how they define hard work and rigor and tenacity in this line of work, whether that's word count or hours in the chair or what that looks like. You know, a baseball player can go in and hit 500 balls off a tee and his hands are bleeding. It's like, yeah, that was good hard work. And so, but in writing and reporting, it's a little different. So like, how does that look to you?
Well, first of all, it means that you do it every way. It means you don't spend a great deal of time and energy figuring out ways not to write. I mean, for me, it means writing every day, except obviously some days when you can't for external reasons or when you're really sick or something. But it means writing every day, and it means part of what it means to me is willingness to rewrite in a really thoroughgoing way, I've had this wonderful privilege of having someone tell me that something isn't working, and then I've learned that for me at least, real rewriting isn't just fixing words or a sentence here or there or moving paragraphs around and stuff. It's sometimes just starting over. And realizing, of course, that you haven't really lost anything. Sometimes what you've done is you've identified the stuff that you're not gonna, that you actually don't want to write about, or that you've just taken a slightly wrong turn. But I think that's very hard work. And I haven't taught very often, but I think it's the hardest thing. It's always been the hardest thing for the students I've had to learn how to do, to accept the fact that, look, you can't fix this by tinkering. You've got to start over,
Right.
I do think that's crucial.
Yeah.
But working hard isn't necessarily a virtue. I mean, it was, it always was it's part of the creed of my people, the WASPs, my father, certainly. I mean, my father, if you got up, by dawn in the summer, half your moral battles of the day were over. Kept working. So I still have some of that, but really it's what you've accomplished. And it certainly isn't the number of words you've written. Mm-hmm. For me, I know others do, but it really has everything to do with how good those words are. For one thing, it's so much harder for me to write something briefly than just to sort of, slap it all down at whatever length. So writing 20 pages is a lot easier for me than writing two sometimes. So it's hard to measure, and I'm not sure I really care anymore whether I feel like I've worked hard or not. I mean, who cares?
Right.
If I could do this without working hard, that'd be fine. I suppose it has everything to do with just how well things are going. It's really, what's really hard is when things are not going well to keep going after it.
With the current work you're doing, I know some people don't like to disclose exactly what they're working on, but maybe we can talk around it in a sense. When I was talking to Susan Orlean last week, in her latest book, she wrote that she didn't think she would write a book again, and yet the library book, which just came out, it like stuck its teeth in her, and she couldn't help but write it. And and writing books is years of your life. And I wonder, you know, after Truck Full of Money came out, you know, what about this next one stuck in your craw, and you're like, this is a book, I got to write this, and, you know, what's bringing you back to it?
Well, I remember the moment, actually, I was doing research with on this guy, and I really don't want to sort of talk about the details of it, but I just,
right,
through the blood doing research, I met someone else, and I remember thinking, I wish I was writing a book about you. And so I pursued that. I wasn't ready to end on that with that book. This one, well, I think I might, you know, I can, there have been lots of times when I've said to myself or to others that this might be the last thing I'll write. But now I'm 72 now, and I do think this one I'm working on now might be the last thing. But it may take me another God knows how many years. I'm just not going to hurry it. And I find it, you know, rich. But I want to go back to a feeling that I had with some other books, which I haven't had with more recent ones. Well, I don't know. That isn't quite true. But what that I really know everything that is germane. That's impossible, of course, and it could be a recipe for utter disaster. research it till you can do it. You can pretty much research anything till you die,
right?
You know,
but it's one of those deals.
But Todd will tell me.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. You said Todd will tell you.
Todd will tell me when to stop. He sort of has told me, you know, that I should get to writing now, and you know, I can always go back, and so I am going to do that. I'm going to spend about a week, a month in research and the rest of it writing.
Yeah. And do you find that sometimes with these stories, even at, you know, 72 years old, you almost can't help yourself when it comes to telling a story. You know, you're a storyteller, and a good story comes along. Is there a part of you that's just like, this is me, this is what I do, I got to do it. I don't care how old I am.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how I'll feel after I finish this. That wasn't quite what I felt. I just thought, yeah, this is worth writing about. I mean, we're living in a very weird time, and I have been tempted to write about other things,
yeah,
particularly politics at one point. But I don't know. By the time I was thinking hard about it, it seemed like the ground was so heavily trodden. I didn't really particularly want to jump in there. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, although I still think it's worth doing. I've got something I really want to do. So that's really, but it's not like, you know, if you're not looking, I'm not sure. Maybe that's not true either. But I can't be sure that. I mean, I've run into some stories that I might have. I've heard of things or things and where I've just said I can't do that. For instance, the Ebola stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I might, in another time in my life, have gone to see and to write about it, but it just didn't feel like I could.
Yeah.
You know, not now.
Right. Well, Tracy. This was wonderful to get to talk to you at length. Just to get dig into your process a bit and talk about your body of work. I hope when the next book comes out, maybe we can have another conversation and dig into some nuance with the latest book. But thank you so much for your time, and thanks for all your work, and we'll certainly be in touch.
Thanks.
You got it, Tracy. Take care.
Okay. Bye.
Bye. Cross that one off the bucket list.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. How'd you like it? I hope you dug it. I tried my bestest for y'all. Thanks very much to this show's sponsors, Goucher College's MFA program in nonfiction and Creative Nonfiction Magazine. You can visit TracyKidder.com for more information about Tracy and his work and events and the like. I believe he has an author Facebook page too, so plug in. While I've got your attention, I'd ask that if you dig the show, share it with a friend, subscribe, and leave an honest review on Apple Podcasts. They're a big, big help, and I'm deeply appreciative of whatever you can do to help out the show. You know, ratings are super quick, just a tap of the thumb. Reviews, though more desired, take a little more energy, but if you can do that, great. If not, no biggie. I'm just happy you're here. Visit BrendanOmara.com to sign up for my monthly newsletter, reading recommendations, and what you might have missed from the world of the podcast once a month. No spam. Can't beat that. I think we're done. Remember, if you can't do interview, see ya. Next week on the Creative Nonfiction Podcast.
Or like my I was an only child, so like all my stuffed animals, I would like make little instruments for them and I'd put a record on and I'd conduct them like they were in an orchestra. So I think I just always wanted to surround myself with those kinds of people. But I don't remember not doing that. And I don't remember not reading, and I don't remember not writing, which I think is a more common thing for writers, like kind of always figuring that out.